This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
This program is sponsored by New Zealand Bridge, sponsors of Grassroots Bridge across the nation.
Welcome to the Bridge Zone. You're at the table with Barry and Mariana. We have got results from the King's birthday weekend. Numbers were pretty good in Auckland.
Yeah, I didn't make it there, but you did. So the pairs on the Saturday, that was won by Leon Mayer and David Taylor. The teams was won by the Ware team again, Mariana.
I know.
Michael Ware, Matthew McManus, Blair and Liz Fisher. Never lost a match. The 3A pairs on the Monday, they had a north-south winner, Jonathan Westerby and Linda Cartner, east-west, Andrew Mickle and Monica Cheng. The intermediates pairs was won by Ellen Walpole and Heather Robertson.
So results from the Hawke's Bay Congress. Again, strong numbers attending there. The winners of the open pairs was Jenna and Christine Gibbons. Intermediates, Mary Scott, Peter Jackson, Jr., David Davidson and Sue Fox-Warren. The open teams winners were the Carrier team.
It was Colin Carrier and Sandra Calvert, Rochelle Pilkman and Murray Wood.
Intermediate teams were won by the Solomon team. And that team was headed by Julie Solomon, Owen Trimmer, Gideon Dupreez and David Davidson. Boy, he had a good tournament. The Swiss pairs was taken out by Graham Stronach and Sandy McKirby. So Dunedin, a quick fly through Dunedin.
Well, we had a bit of a trouble with the Otago Congress. The team's result doesn't seem to be up, but the winners of the pairs was Kevin Skoropada and Lindsay Glover, just ahead of Greg Buzzard and Moss Wiley. One more result, Mariana, and this is a biggie.
What is it?
It's from Bangkok.
Oh.
So the APPF in Bangkok held last week. There were no New Zealand teams sent, but there were self-funded teams in the mixed and the open. And the open team actually won the whole thing. So that was Go Tislevol and Leon Mayer, Ashley Bart and Nick Jacobs. So well done to them.
To follow is the end of our chat with Alan Morris, Chair of NZ Bridge, who joined us last week celebrating our 300th episode.
What else would you like to chat about?
Can we talk about youth? What's happening in the youth space?
That I can't answer because I haven't got that at my fingertips. Interestingly, at the Transnationals in Bangkok last week, there was a youth event that was graded from under 16s to groups of under 26. They had 82 pairs.
Wow.
Which was really exciting to watch. They all come in their school colours or whatever it might be. And it's just the difference in the environment. So with a lot of countries in Asia, they're recognised by the ICO. Therefore, they have government support and government funding. They are connected into the education system. And so their ability to kind of drive youth is excellent. Here, we're not recognised as a sport. We have no government funding. And unless we've got enthusiastic teachers within the school system, we are not connecting with youth. So youth is a challenge that we need to think about and how we grow that. If you look at other countries like France, run a program called Les Petits, which is designed for 5 to 7 year olds. So they're trying to get them in very early. So we need to do some deep thinking about how we manage youth. On the flip side of that, you've got countries like the Netherlands who are running a program for loneliness. And they've worked with their municipalities in the Netherlands, identify those people that are living on their own, and with the support of the municipality, have been offering Bridge as a tool to cope with loneliness. In the Netherlands, they ran a program 2012 to 2014 and then did it again in 2018 and again in 2022. They got something like 15,000 new members.
Wow.
So that has appeal that we need to look at. Those two countries in particular are really very supportive to share information. You know, it's great having it, but then you've got to see how can you make it work and all of those things. So that's exciting. When we look at our teaching program here, and we're getting quite a lot of people who come through the door who do the lessons, the retention rate's very low when you look at it. And you have to ask yourself, why is that the case? And so last weekend, the Teaching and Learning Committee met. I haven't seen the results of that meeting. I did participate in the first day to give some guidance from the board's perspective, where retention is one of our key activities and trying to improve retention for clubs. That's good for the club and it's good for the sport as a whole, or the game as a whole. We've got to focus on, in my opinion, the quality of our teachers. They are the ambassadors to the game. They're the first people that beginners see and react to. They're the ones that need to give an exciting experience to our beginners and help in the conversion into the club environment. We accept not everybody is going to be a club player. That will be an exciting piece of work, which we'll share as the committee advances what they're doing. Part of that is they've got to review the material that we've got. We've got to make sure it is up to date. We've got to contemporize that material so it's available in whatever medium is required for delivery. We've got to use more technology and videos and stuff like that to assist our teachers from around the country. So that's an exciting bit. There are some initiatives over and above youth in terms of trying to support the growth of the game.
We had Catherine Goff Wellington on last week, and she was telling us that they make a contribution towards lessons. And one of the conditions is they get told what the retention rate is, which is about 40%. Do you have any idea whether that's sort of general throughout the country? Or
no, that's very good. Wellington, it gets back to the quality of the teacher and how many you're putting through. The bigger clubs have got more resource to do that. If you get into some of the small regional clubs where you might only get a couple of people doing the lessons, then you've got the challenge of integration. So Wellington got the chance of supervised sessions when you migrate. So it's that migration from the lessons. I'm convinced that running a 10-block lesson is too much.
Yep, I agree.
It's long, isn't it?
It's too long. It's too hard. We need to be in much smaller blocks, which that's what they did talk about over the weekend, 3 or 4 week block, and then play. Get the people playing. Overseas, they use mini bridge a lot to start with. Get people with cards in their hands, learning how to take tricks, and then do small blocks. They're giving some thought to what is the best way forward.
Yeah.
Another quick question, seeing as you're in Bangkok, talking to a couple of people, some of those teams, and I know this isn't, I'm not suggesting this will ever happen here, but some of those teams get government funding.
Yeah, they do.
Much talk about that, Alan?
If you look at Asia, particularly for, not so much for the transnational, but for the Asian Games, it has more importance than the Olympics or the Mind Games, because the governments fund that. Okay, it's part of their connection with the IOC, and so they get a lot of government funding in that respect. There are some challenges that the Asian Games, which are next in Japan in 2026 or something, Bridges not on the calendar.
Oh,
because it's up to the host country of what sports they run. And so there lies the challenge. You say, why do they support the Asian Games over WBF type events? Well, if you're in Asia, if you're not China, perhaps if you're not Chinese Taipei, if you're not China Hong Kong, or the Open in, say, Indonesia, your chances of representation are low.
Mm.
They have 3 spots into the World Championships. We have 2 spots. We're very fortunate. So they put a lot of emphasis on their regional or zonal matches. But funding is a big, big part of that. You tell me why China, with over 1 billion people, only have 47,000 registered players.
Mm.
You tell me why India, with over 1 billion people, biggest country in the world, has 4,000 players and 10,000 social players.
That's terrible, isn't it?
When you think about China, you sort of think about, you know, they have good teams and they seem to have lots of government funding. But actually, when you look at those numbers, they're not that impressive.
So for that size, I mean, Australia, 30,000 members, which is way down, with a population of, what, 26, 27 million. New Zealand, 12,500 members with our population of five and a half million. Yeah, we're a fairly large MBO. When we went to Bangkok, actually, whilst it was invaluable and enlightening, and it was about the relationships with the WBF, which were really, really great, if you look at all the entities we should be associating with are the larger MBOs with similar problems to us. Us aligning with Asia, where the situation is very different in terms of government support, government funding, type of membership. Yeah, Philippines, you know, I don't know what the population of the Philippines is, but their registered players, 43.
Oh, okay.
Our issues are totally different. Totally different. It was a really good exercise going over there and sharing things. And we spent a lot of time with the ABF guys that went as well, which was handy as well.
So I just looked up the population of the Philippines, 115.6 million.
Yeah.
But that was in 2022, so it would have grown a little bit by then.
They only have a club in Manila and they have 43 registered players.
We've got one in Hamilton.
Okay. Thank you, Alan. That's given us plenty to put in our 300th program, Mariana.
That's amazing. Hey, just tell me, who's on the Teaching and Learning Committee?
That's chaired by Douglas Russell, and on that committee is Kate and Anna, then Shirley Newton from Christchurch, Mary Christensen from Queenstown, Sonia Adams from Wanaka, Phil Noy from Otago, Alan Grant from
Wellington. Well, that's a pretty big committee, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah. There's a lot of work in that area. Hopefully I haven't left anybody out. I'm just...
Any famous last words, Mr. Morris?
Look, I just hope people enjoy playing and getting back to supporting the clubs during club play and the tournaments. We're seeing that. We're seeing an uplift in people returning to the game. Those who left because of COVID or for any other reason are now starting to come back, which is really exciting. What we do about youth, I think that's a big issue. That ABF and Paul Marsden are running a youth program. They got 121, I think. The ABF is sponsoring the first 4 weeks, and then it becomes commercial with Paul and those players. It'll be interesting to see what the final numbers look like. They did that by really working with the clubs and grandkids and all sorts coming into the game. We just got to step out of the old paradigm of how we connect with these people.
True.
You've got to have youth talking to youth. They speak a different language.
Yeah, they most certainly do.
Most of it seems to be via text.
By all sorts of mediums. All right.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, keep well, guys, and congratulations.
See you. Thanks a lot.
Ciao.
G'day, it's Pete here, and today I wanted to talk about misused conventions. Number 4 on my list is also pretty similar. This one is Roman Key Card. How is Roman key card misused? So let's have a look at an example auction. So it might go one heart and people jump the four no trumps. The good thing about Roman key card is there's no real misunderstandings of when it applies. Most people know what it is because it's the four no trump bid and you get a Roman key card answer. So what is misused about Roman key card? First of all, is people use it as their only slam try move. Like, they go, okay, I want to go to slam. All right, let's use Roman key card. Whereas I don't think that should be the application for it. There should be other slam going moves that you can make before you actually use Roman key card. So Roman key card should be the last step you do before you're about to bid slam. And it should say, I was about to bid slam, but I just wanted to check that we're not missing two key cards. Whereas most people think that Roman key card is the only way that you tell partner that you're interested in slam, but it doesn't elicit an appropriate response of, yes, I want to go to slam or not. It just checks, are we missing any of these two key cards or not? First misuse of Roman key card is the thought that this is our only slam going move, when you should really be incorporating cue bidding and other conventions as well, but other sorts of ways to elicit input from your partner about whether you want to go to slam or not. The second thing that I see people misuse keycard with is that when they get a response, they find out they're only missing one keycard, but then they think that being off one keycard scares them out of bidding slam. Now, that is not what keycard's for. You're allowed to be missing one keycard and still bid slam. You don't want to be missing two keycards. So if you are just missing one ace or one king of trumps, then you can happily still bid slam. But lots of people will just see this and then go, oh, I'm missing one, and then stop. So that's another way that Roman keycard's misused. The third way that Roman keycard's misused is that people don't know to ask for the queen. So this might show one or four keycards, or zero or three keycards, and you find out you're missing one keycard, but you still don't know about the queen of trumps. So you can ask by bidding the next step that isn't the trump suit. And this would say, partner, do you have the queen of trumps? Because with Roman keycard, you don't want to be off a keycard and the queen of trumps. So asking for the queen of trumps is a step that people often miss with Roman keycard. And then my final issue is that people that use Roman keycard often don't know what the response is because they've rushed ahead. I don't like using Roman keycard if I can't tell if partner's got one keycard or four keycards. And occasionally I see auctions like this where it goes 5 hearts past 6 hearts past 7 hearts. And they miss the opportunity to ask for kings or have a more informative sort of auction when you don't know what your partner's response is. The issue with this is sometimes people hesitate a lot before signing off. And then you've got three keycards, and was that enough? And then you choose to bid on. Firstly, I try and avoid it. I assume that my partner does know the difference between do I have zero or do I have three. If they don't know that, then they probably should have done some more informative slam bidding before it. So it's not always the case that that can happen, but these sorts of auctions aren't great because I think you should actually know what your partner's response is going to be. Is it zero or is it three, rather than trying to piece it together? So that was number four on my list of most misused conventions, Roman keycard.
Director, please.
Judge Judy is in session. It's the bailiff today.
He is Patrick.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you feeling after a busy weekend?
It was a long weekend, always is. Julie and I were a little bit under the weather, but I think we're okay now.
You haven't got COVID, have you?
No, definitely not COVID. We were both fighting off the end of a little bit of a cold.
Auckland, so COVID stopped me making it to Auckland for the weekend.
Yeah.
We want to talk about unauthorised information, and I understand that you had a pretty interesting situation over the weekend, Patrick.
Well, yes, it was quite a good one to demonstrate this. Let's start out by talking about the hand without the unauthorised information. You're not vulnerable against vulnerable, and you open four clubs, and you're holding a doubleton ace, a singleton heart, jack doubleton diamond, and queen jack to eight clubs. So as you can see, if you play four clubs as natural, that's a reasonable pull to make. And when four clubs pass, four hearts from partner, and double from the next hand. Well, partner's heard your four club bid, and you've described your hand. You wouldn't bid any more, would you? You've told partner you've got lots of clubs, and they've bid four hearts. So you would pass.
I'd have thought that was partner's lucky day. I bet she got a heart.
Yeah, well, she's got a heart in your hand, whereas she might not have got any hearts in your hand. So that's the situation. If you didn't have unauthorised information, you would pass at this point. Well, what actually happened at the table was, while the stop card was out, the next person asked what the four club bid was, and their partner said, I think it shows hearts. So when four clubs pass, four hearts from partner, which you now know is because partner's got your system wrong or misremembered what you were playing. Not a very familiar partnership. So it went four clubs pass, four hearts, double. And when it was double, the hand that we've just agreed you would pass on, they now bid five clubs on because, oh, they doubled. So of course I would bid five clubs because they've doubled four hearts. You're not supposed to be able to save yourself from a misunderstanding because you've heard partner's explanation. There's lots of ways you can get unauthorised information, and one of them is because you happen to be able to hear when partner gives an explanation about your bidding. Sometimes in some tournaments there's a big screen across the table, so you can't hear what partner is writing down what the bid means. So you're not allowed to use that information, which you're not allowed to know about, to save yourself from a misunderstanding. When it went five clubs and went past double at the table, because partner had a very balanced hand with three clubs to the king and no other cards, a 4-3 hand, five clubs doubled, went down three, and I had to adjust the board to four hearts doubled, going down nine, which was 2,300 instead of 500. And the pair concerned weren't very happy about it. One of the things they said was, I wasn't very sure about it being hearts. I would have removed it to five clubs myself because I wasn't sure about it. Well, their partner, by taking advantage of the unauthorized information, didn't give them the chance to do that. Like they had gone four clubs, pass, four hearts, double, pass, and the person who wasn't very sure about whether it was clubs or whether it was hearts, they didn't have any unauthorized information because they heard themselves give their own the explanation. So maybe they could have hit five clubs themselves, but we'll never know whether they would have because their partner, by taking advantage of the unauthorized information to bid five clubs and rebid their hand when they'd already told their partner what they got, they sort of deprived them of that information. And how would the director be able to take that into account? Oh, you know, I think there's a 50% chance they gave an explanation one way, and if it goes four hearts, double, pass, why would I assume that they might have changed their mind? It would have been an interesting question, but I couldn't see how you could take advantage of that. So the score of 500 was changed to a score of 2,300. The stupid director initially gave them 2,600 because I'd just changed it to hearts without realizing I'd left it still on five. So, it wasn't 2,600, it was only 2,300.
By the way, mind light,
because on defense, they just had the ace of spades, and there's no way you'd make any other trick. Sometimes it's harder to defend. If you're playing in a stupid contract, sometimes the defenders will let you make an extra trick or two because it's harder to defend. If you're playing the hand to see what you've got, you'd make a certain number of tricks. And if you're defending, sometimes it's easier to let the clearer score an extra trick. But I couldn't see how that was likely to happen at all. So, yes, it was pretty clear.
Wow.
It made one trick playing four hearts double. That's all I gave them.
Crikey.
Sounds like another weekend where Patrick's not going to win the most popular director of the board.
Not with that pair. Julie had to take away a couple of boards in the teams, and I don't think they were impressed that they had boards taken away. And so perhaps Julie wouldn't win the most popular director award either. But I don't think I had particularly controversial. And that shouldn't have been controversial anyway. One of the reasons they did not appeal was that they wouldn't have qualified anyway. And because I was trying to calm them down, I said, look, if you want to, you can always appeal it. And I almost suggested that they appeal it. So I would have encouraged an appeal committee not to give them an adjustment for a frivolous appeal. But it really was a straightforward ruling that an appeal committee should have said, why are you appealing? So I would have had to tell the appeal committee, look, I almost encourage them to appeal it because it's a big score and because they were clearly upset. I would have discouraged the appeal committee from giving a frivolous appeal award, but that's another matter. It should have been straightforward. I'm sure your listeners, some of them will be thinking, God, why would the director make such a big adjustment? But if you've saved yourself from a big misunderstanding because you've used unauthorized information, why should the size of that save make a difference? Why should it be, oh, if it was only a trick or two, the director can adjust by that much? But if we've saved that from a bigger misunderstanding for a score of 1,800 points difference, oh, the director shouldn't give the whole 1,800 points.
I'm not sure that this is relevant, but I did just happen to notice, I'm pretty sure that the side that went for 2,300 won the match by 2 imps.
I said, look, I know it's a really big adjustment, but you still might win the match. The side that I ruled against won the match by 2 imps. So they still got their fractional 8 points for doing that because you can have a really big score on my board. When they were playing, neither side was going to be able to qualify from there. I think maybe if one side had got a 20-point win, maybe that would have been close, but I'm not sure even that's good enough.
Heck, I've never heard of unauthorized information costing that much, Barry.
Yeah. Maybe you could discuss whether that hand should be open four clubs or five clubs. Because while I might agree with four clubs vulnerable, if you have that in your system, I think not Bull against Bull, I'm a five club bet.
Right.
If you're not going to open that hand five clubs, when are you going to open five clubs?
I don't know. Maybe you need nine of them.
You'll wait a long time, won't you?
You will.
What I do know is that once you open it, like either the three level, you don't have another chunk of it.
Indeed.
You don't get another bite.
I mean, I know this is the directing part of it, but certainly from a teaching bridge point of view, you preempt, and that's it. Anything else is up to partner, because you tell partner about your hand and their partner is in control. You don't think, I've got a hand worth preempting this much, and then change your mind next time around and say, I've got a hand worth preempting a bit more. The whole idea about preempting is you preempt as much as you dare, and then that's it, right? So,
yeah.
If you decide it's a three-club opener, anything else is up to partner. If you decide it's a four-club opener, anything else is up to partner.
And there we have a tip from Patrick.
And if you decide it's a five-club opener, the same thing applies.
Okay.
See you later. Now, were you playing something online against Australia?
Oh, this is the transnational thing.
Is that finished?
No, that is sort of once a month or something. The next one's on the 14th of June, I think.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, guess what? I'm on the move again, Barry. I'll be travelling down to Dunedin for a week this Friday. So the Bridge Zone's coming from Dunedin next week, folks.
Are you going to have a game while you're down there?
Yeah, I'm going to try and get a game.
Oh, that'll be good.
I'll be able to figure out why their team's results weren't showing. I'll get the goss on that. Let's sign off with a tip from you for this week.
I'm just going to reinforce Patrick's tip because it was a good one. And that is, if you're going to preempt, whether you preempt three hearts or four hearts or two hearts or whatever you do, that's the end for you. Partner's in charge. Once you've preempted, don't bid again. That's usually pretty good advice. So if you preempt and they outbid you, well, you better hope that they're wrong, or that if anybody's going to compete further, it's going to be your partner. It won't be you. So once you've opened a preempt, you can sit back and relax. The rest is up to partner.
That smacks just like the lessons. When you open one no trump, your partner becomes the boss.
Partner's the captain.
Yep. Well, I hope you get back to the bridge table this week.
Well, there's going to be a tournament at Te Aroha on Saturday, the Spartown teams. Quite good numbers entered for Te Aroha. I think they've got more than 20 teams entered, so should be a good event.
Should be. It's always a good day over there.
Are you going over?
No, I just told you I'm going to Dunedin.
Oh, you did. Yeah, that's right. You didn't.
See, folks, he is old. COVID.
Oh, God.
COVID's affecting his brain. It's not. It's the age thing. All right, folks. We'll catch you next week.
Bye for now.
New Zealand Bridge, sponsoring bridge from beginner to international nationwide.
For more episodes, use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.